Committee. For the record, today is February 17th. We are going to have some potential difficulty with quorums here this morning. We have two work sessions, or one work session. We'll do both bills, both reports. But I know people have to come and go. We're just going to try to get this done as quickly as we can and still have a reasonable discussion. But we need to get these reports recognized and moved forward. They do have budget implications, at least for one of them, the other for long term. So I think the Senate is in pretty good shape for staying. But the House, I know, is going back and forth to just the way things go. Okay? So, LFO, would you start us out? I'm going to open a work session. I'm going to do it in both bills.
Do a work session on each report.
Each report. Department of Human Service report on program sustainability, and Oregon Health Authority report on potential investments related to rural hospitals. I would like to, if possible, do the rural hospital one first because it's simpler. Okay. Okay, I want to get through it quickly. And then we can move on to the more difficult one where we'll have people come and going a bit. Is that okay?
Fine, as long as we can switch gears quickly here.
Okay, folks. I think everybody is here who's for both these reports. So Oregon Health Authority first, then. Please come forward.
Can you call Linda?
Where'd Linda go?
She left because she didn't. We were doing roll hospitals. Fine.
It's going to be this is going to be a lot more straightforward and simple. I want to get at least this one done today.
Mr. Co-Chair, so while the agency is getting their stuff pulled up, including in all this today, there's an analysis on this report, a copy of the report, and there's also a presentation from the Oregon Health Authority and OLAS, and they're going to get that pulled up if you want to look at it in the system in the meantime. So I believe there was a budget note as part of material from the 2015 legislative session directing the Oregon Health Authority to work with some stakeholders to gather input on some ideas about how to ensure that Oregon's small and rural hospitals could continue to be sustainable in the future. I think there was some discussion about maybe trying to find some funding opportunities to make some investments and move on forward on some of those programs or ideas, and the department's back today to give you a presentation and some feedback on what some of those ideas are.
Thank you. For the record, would you introduce yourselves to the committee? And I'd like to hear your testimony.
Excellent. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Bates and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Nass with the Oregon Health Authority. I'm the Deputy Director of Finance there. I'm really excited to be here in response to this budget note. We worked collaboratively a lot over the last couple of months, and then even before that for 2 years, which you'll hear this process of looking at rural hospitals and what we can do to help transform their health systems and whatnot. So with me, I'd like to have my colleagues introduce themselves.
Chair Senator Bates and members of the committee, Co-Chair Nathanson, thank you for having me. I'm Andy Van Pelt, the Executive Vice President for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems.
Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson and committee, my name is Rick Yesney. I'm Chief Administrative Officer at Peace Health Peace Harbor Hospital in Florence, Oregon.
And I also want to note that my colleague Jeff Scroggins from the Oregon Health Authority will also pop up to talk once I'm done with some of the financial pieces. He'll talk more about the investments. And I also want to say that behind me is Charlie Twite from Lake District Hospital down in Lake County. So he's traveled the ways here to show his support for this investment as well. So we're here in response to a budget note that was included in Senate Bill 5507. It basically asked us to do two things. One was to engage in a rural hospital stakeholder group, which you're going to hear a little bit more about this and the recommendations we've come up with to ensure that Oregon's small and rural hospitals can continue to be sustainable in the future.
Okay, I'll come.
And then develop recommendations, which you'll hear four of those today. Additionally, the budget note asked us to respond on what the ending balance is of the previous hospital assessment program that ended in October of 2015. So with final accounting, that takes until December to kind of get everything figured out. So end of December, early January, we finally had a number. So that asked us to report on that. So with the ending of the 2013-2015 hospital assessment program, OHA identified that there was $35 million of unallocated other funds available for use, of which we're asking for up to $10 million, $10 million to go towards this rural hospital investment. So with that, I think that answers most of my financial pieces, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues unless someone has questions. Excellent.
Thank you for your testimony.
So this has been a very broad stakeholder process over the past, I'd say, almost 18 months. As you can see, we've engaged in several various areas. The 32 rural hospitals in Oregon all completed a transformation readiness assessment. We hosted at our organization four regional meetings around the state. We hosted a rural summit last June. We are part of the OHA and the Oregon Office of Rural Health listening tour around the state, where we visited in all the rural communities. And we'll flip to the next slide, and you can see all the various meetings we've had over the past 2 years to really vet this and understand the critical needs in our rural markets. So obviously, you have this in front of you. I'm not going to read through every meeting. But I would like Rick Yesney here to also share some insight on the vetting process we went through.
Thank you, and thanks for having us today. My other role is I'm also from the Hospital Association. I'm the chair of the Small and Rural Committee, which represents our 32 rural hospitals in the state of Oregon, and also was the co-chair with OHA on the work group that's bringing these proposals forward. And just want to make three real brief points. You've got the written testimony that we prepared. But I thought I would highlight, first of all, the process itself, that it was very comprehensive and took 2 years, really, of listening tours and rural health summits with our rural providers across all corners of the state. So it was very comprehensive. Out of that, the two main points I think that we'd like to emphasize are that we're really engaged with transformation in the rural communities, but resources are fairly scarce. So it was really wonderful news that this $10 million investment might be available for transformation of care. Gesundheit.
Thank you.
Secondly, you know, we also found out that our 32 hospitals are really in various phases of this transformation in healthcare. So you're going to see four separate programs, and each hospital will be able to tailor their own program to meet their own community needs and where they're at in the transformation right now. So we think the package is really well thought out. It provides not only programs, but education and training, which I think is really important. So when we talk about population health, we know what we're talking about. We have the same vocabulary. It's a very important piece of the project. And just on behalf of the small and rural hospitals, we urge you to support this one-time funding of up to $10 million for these four programs. And thank you for your support of our rural healthcare systems. And Charlie Twait and I will also be available at the end of the program to answer any questions you might have directly from rural hospitals. Thank you.
Co-chairs Bates, Nathanson, Jeff Scroggins, for the record, my colleague Kate Nass introduced me. The next slide speaks to the recommendation criteria that were used by the OHA and hospital stakeholder group. You see the triple aim in them. I won't read them out loud. They go to what Charlie was just talking about.
So the first recommendation is probably the most significant investment of these funds, and it is a new model of care looking at critical access hospital capacities within those hospitals. Again, in Oregon, we have 25 critical access hospitals out of our 32 total rural hospitals, and repositioning capacity in what's called a swing bed program. So this is a post-acute care model. It's playing out in three states right now. It's a three-year program, really upfront training for clinical staff. And the idea is to create or target high acuity patients that are on average 15 days within a large tertiary center, so a large urban facility. And how do you transition these patients back to their local communities for that higher level of care and utilize infrastructure that is in the rural setting? So looking at a partnership with the Mayo Clinic, obviously a clinically reputable organization to help do this. Again, a three-year program. There will be investment by the hospitals in terms of staff time and support to be able to prepare for this higher level of acuity. From a cost standpoint, it helps with hospital, what we call hospital throughput. So a lot of our tertiary centers are at capacity right now. And so how do we move those patients out of those facilities to allow them then to see more patients at the urban setting? And so we're pretty excited about this. And overall, as you can see from the slide, depending on hospital participation and their capacity within a critical access hospital to maintain a swing bed program, it could be between $4 to $7 million over the 3-year period of the state's investment of $10 million.
Yes.
I'd like you to say just a bit more about the throughput issue.
Sure.
From a previous conversation, I came to understand that with being at capacity or very close to capacity at a large hospital such as the one not in my district but next door to my district, the one that my constituents mm-hmm. would use, what does that mean? Does that put some patients, potential patients, in jeopardy of not having a space at the hospital where they need to be treated? Can you explain that?
Sure. Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, I'm actually going to let Rick answer that, who runs a hospital day to day and can better answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson. This our facility in Lane County, which is a critical access hospital, refers to Riverbend Hospital, a tertiary facility in Eugene that's often full, and that's what we're finding is a lot of the urban tertiary referral centers are full, and our patients are having to go to up the valley to Corvallis, Salem, even OHSU, because they can't get in. And we find we have capacity at our smaller hospitals, our critical access hospitals. So this allows patients that are at the tertiary center when it's appropriate to come back to their rural community, which we have open beds, and frees up beds for our patients that need to be seen at our tertiary center as close to home as possible and receive the proper care. So it's almost adding capacity within a network of hospitals. And in our case, there's even been some discussion about adding rooms at the tertiary center that maybe we can avoid by using the open hospital beds at the rural facilities.
So a brief follow-up. So that means sometimes you are having to send patients a longer distance.
Correct.
To not necessarily the preferred, closest, or best facility. You have to send them somewhere else because
Correct.
Of the capacity problem.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair. That's perfectly
just
said.
If I could, I'll step out of my role here as a senator. I'll put a finer point on this. I've worked in these small hospitals before, and one of the issues for small hospitals is the up and down census. You could have a full hospital one day with 10, 15 beds full or up to 30 beds full, and the next day you've got two, but you still have to maintain staff just in case. And so it's up and down is really difficult. The other part of this is what you've already spoken to. At Rogue Valley Medical Center, we commonly are on red alert, and that means we have no beds left. And when that happens, we start stacking patients in the emergency room, which backs the emergency room up, and then we start setting them up I-5 as far as Eugene. And then you guys are full past that.
Right.
So it's really a way of resolving these kind of issues. The other issue is a patient issue. If you're at a major medical center, but you're from a rural area, and you're in a recovery phase, and you would rather be home near your family and friends than in a massive hospital, as nice as these hospitals are nowadays, not knocking big hospitals, you'd rather be home. You'd rather be in Lakeview. You'd rather be at Florence. You'd rather be maybe in Klamath Falls or even other areas in the rural part of the state. So it's a win-win all the way around. But it will take some extra training and some plans, and I'll say this now. I think these kinds of programs need to be more than 3 or 4 years. We need to make these permanent programs, and the funding source, as far as I'm concerned, should be the provider assessment. That's a natural place to take this to enhance and help our rural facilities. So I'll stop. Keep going.
Okay, can I have?
Now you have to go for sure. She has to testify another bill, but she's...
I'll be right back.
The Senator will be right back. That's the kind of way we're at right now.
Co-chairs, the second recommendation is to support the work of the Oregon Graduate Medical Education Consortium. And this makes a strategic investment in that consortium, which is focused on residency slots, and specifically up to 42 residency slots, so that we can have primary care providers trained in our hospitals in rural Oregon, so they have a chance to stay in rural Oregon and see why that's a great place to practice primary care, and we can increase the workforce. The third recommendation is around education modules for population health and the social determinants of health. And this is just setting a baseline in the with our rural health leaders and rural health executives and hospital systems so that we all are on the same page regarding population health and social determinants of health. And we do think there's an opportunity to align with some of the work going on in public health modernization because the priority there is on the foundational elements of public health and population health and the social determinants of health. So it's a small amount of relatively of money, but we think it's a good idea to align across the state on the social determinants of health and population health.
And if I may add just a note to this, I think the executive's approval on board of transformation and what it means, but there's a group of people out there who actually have to do it that are so busy and so tied up with their practices, they don't come to meetings, they don't listen to it. And transformation, I'm talking about my fellow physicians, are like, what? You know, and this gives you an opportunity with rural physicians who are incredibly overworked to have some time to sit down and listen to what's really going on and learn from their CEOs how to move it forward. So this is really pretty important from the point of view of what happens on the ground. And I know that even in a big city like Medford, comparatively speaking, getting 30 or 40 doctors together is like pulling teeth. If you can't give them some CME and a chance to get together one evening and liquor them up a little bit and get them to listen, okay? So please continue. That was awful.
Yes,
we never
Chair.
Drink any alcohol when we have our meetings. Just so you know. My nose is getting longer.
And the,
please continue.
Sorry. And the final recommendation is this establishment of virtual clinics in our rural communities. I would think of this as an opportunity to extend time, extend care beyond the 8-to-5 or traditional window pre-emergency room visit. It also brings to bear licensed providers in Oregon immediately that can create a relationship with their local hospital to triage care, to provide care in a different venue via telephone, because a lot of our rural communities continue to struggle with internet access, or through virtual clinics. One idea is to set these kiosks, frankly, up in emergency rooms to divert traffic from emergency departments. Over the past 5 years, we've seen a 20% increase in ED utilization in our rural hospitals. So the notion that, looking across all payers, the notion that ED volume is going down simply is not true. So how do we create intervention opportunities using technology? And the beauty of this program is it can bring providers to bear immediately in rural markets for these rural communities. This one is to pay for the upfront cost. That is a large barrier for our hospitals, those upfront costs of putting this type of program in place. But the sustainability of the program long term would be something that the hospital would be required to continue moving forward with.
Just a quick note, co-chairs, there's a workforce component to this recommendation as well. You know, there's a lot of those docs in the rural area that are frankly overworked, and they just don't have the capacity to meet the need. And this kind of has a valve that may improve the condition there for them as well. So there's that workforce component that we appreciate. This concludes our presentation.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to give this a
questions?
Thank you. I had a constituent a few years ago who received an injury in his eye while he was bow hunting, and it ended up being a sliver or a thorn from a salmonberry plant, and it was stuck in his eye. And he went into the emergency department in my area, in a small hospital, and the doctor that he caught on call there wasn't an ophthalmologist, and he was freaked out a little bit. So he called a friend in Bend, and they connected by the internet with a screen and everything, and he walked him through the treatment just online like that. It was very cool. Saved, transport of a patient, and he didn't really know how long it would. I don't know what happens. They get infected or whatever. But all in all, it was a win-win all the way around. It was simple, easy, and everybody was happy.
He's coming.
So it's a good idea.
He's coming.
Question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation and all the work that's gone into it. I just wanted to mention, because you highlighted social determinants of health and population health in that third bullet, a conversation that I had, and I just want to get on the record because I was very excited about it. And it was a conversation with two people that I think, Andy Van Pelt, you are probably very close to. One is your president of the Oregon Association of hospitals and health systems. And the other was Greg Van Pelt, who is the, I'm guessing might be related to you.
It might be. I hear that a lot.
I'll tell you.
Oregon
that.
Health Leadership Council.
Yeah.
And it was about making sure that we connect hospitals and healthcare systems to the housing issue because of the lack of affordable housing. I just looked up Florence, and it's 2.5% rental vacancy. Bill Hall, Commissioner Bill Hall, has talked about Lincoln City being below 2%. And one of the ideas that I just want to keep sprinkling out there is to since hospitals and CCOs have to hold a certain amount of money in reserves, you know, to really think about hospitals maybe thinking about getting more into real estate and developing affordable housing, because you know that if you release people from emergency rooms and they have nowhere to go, it doesn't. So anyway, that was a fabulous conversation I had with those two folks.
I will follow up.
Yes, please follow up. So thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
Do you want a motion?
Oh, cool. No.
All that
stuff. Senator Devlin, I do need you here.
Okay, I will be here about 2 minutes.
That's all it takes.
Okay. Would you like a motion right now?
Yes. Can you have a motion, please?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move to acknowledge receipt of the report.
We have a motion to acknowledge receipt of the report. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none. Anyone opposed to this, receptive to this report? Seeing none. Passes. I want to thank you all for coming today. I know you came from Lakeview. Thank you very much. And Florence, and you guys don't count. But thank you very much for your report, and more importantly, all the hard work you do getting it to this point and bringing us a logical and thoughtful plan that I think is going to help rural Oregon. We don't do enough for rural Oregon. This is an opportunity to do at least a little bit for you guys. So thank you very much for the good work you've done.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Coach.
Thank you.
Judge. And Carrier in full. Maybe I'll take this one. What do you think? Is it okay? I'll carry it in full. So we're going to close the work session on the bill the report we just accepted, and we're going to open a work session on Department of Human Service report on program sustainability. And you can leave. Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, while the agency and representative from the loan group comes up. So there was a budget note, also a budget note for the Department of Human Services in the 15 session, directing them to work on some options for APD or sustainability in the aging with people with disabilities and intellectual and developmental disabilities programs. There had been a lot of cost and caseload increases to deal with as part of the 2015-17 budget development process, and there was a request for some work to be done for them to come back. This is a report. I fully expect that this will be ongoing work that will come before this committee throughout the NRA.
Okay. Thank you. This is an extremely difficult issue. We've had multiple meetings for hours and hours and hours, meeting with agency heads, walking through and getting an understanding of this issue. Basically, in the very simplest of terms, we brought in something called a K waiver. As a result of that, in the Affordable Care Act, we've had an explosion in the number of people in this program, these two programs, and the cost per case has gone up. This is unsustainable, and we all know it. The question is, what direction we go to bring it back under control, and how do we go about doing it? I think there's a sort of a disconnect inside some of our groups about whether we should do something right now to try to bring this thing under control. Work for 2017. I admit that the money is available to continue through the next session on these programs as they are, but I think that's a mistake to do that. We need to start taking action now and start moving in the right direction to bring these programs back under control, with the understanding that the people who are in these programs, the DD population, the APD population, are some of the most vulnerable people in our society, and we have a responsibility both morally and financially to give them the help they need to have a life that is worthwhile and fulfilling. So I'll stop there, and I'd ask you to introduce yourself to the committee and give us your report.
Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Singer. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for Aging and People with Disabilities, and I'll let the Loon Group introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alexi. I'm with the Lewin Group. I'm a Senior Vice President and Director of the Center for Aging and Disability Policy.
So as was mentioned, we're here today to respond to a budget note from the 2015 legislative session from House Bill 5026. The budget note specifically asks the Department of Human Services to come back and discuss sustainability around services for older adults, individuals experiencing a physical disability, and individuals experiencing intellectual or developmental disability, with the ultimate goal of capping general fund growth at a biennial cap of 10% per biennium. The department, in looking at this budget note, decided to bring in an independent contractor to look at options for the department. The department went out for public procurement and ultimately contracted with the Lewin Group to do this work. The Lewin Group only had a few months to be able to look at our systems and services and to be able to respond to the budget note. We brought them here today. You should have in your packets materials a report that was prepared by the Lewin Group. Ultimately, we respectfully hope that this committee will acknowledge receipt of the report, and so we will ask that at one point during this presentation. But today, the Lewin Group's here as an independent contractor to provide their analysis of options that Oregon could take to be able to meet the goals and items outlined in that budget note. With that, I'll turn it over to the Lewin Group.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bates and members. Oregon has led the country in its ability to move people out of institutions into home community-based settings where they want to live their lives. And because you are so far ahead of the curve, this makes looking at reducing the rate of increase a little bit more difficult here than it is in other states. Other states can like actively try to get people out of institutions and which tend to be more expensive and into lower cost settings. And while Oregon continues to do this, the rate at which it's able to do it is going to be much less than another state that's not far this far along. So our study focused on looking forward, looking at that, trying to get to a 10% biennium rate of growth, and it identified potential strategies to kind of bend the cost curve. So we looked at both historical caseload and expenditures, and it's important to look at APD and IDD separately. They're very different systems, and they have different underlying issues going on with them. We also explored a number of policy scenarios, and they included reducing the growth in the number of participants, reducing the growth in payments per participant, changing cost share requirements, and greater integration of primary acute pharmacy and long-term services and supports, as well as leveraging technology. Although we explored implementation issues, we don't really address that in this particular presentation due to time. Looking at the services for IDD, we looked at all the home and community-based services for aging and people with disabilities. For IDD, we focused on those where they were receiving services, so case management only was not included in our analyses. We were also unable to include intensive in-home children's services due to data limitations. And they're an important high-cost group, but they are actually a very small percentage of the total budget. So we don't think that has a big impact on what we were able to explore. For APD, since 2009, the spending has increased 70%. This is total spending, not just state spending, state general revenue. And half of that increase, 32%, has occurred since 2013 when the K plan was implemented, but not all of it is due to the K plan. There are a number of other things that were going on in the state at the same time, bargained wage increases, other wage increases, efforts to there were also caseload increases that were specifically related to the K plan. And most of the increase, as you can see here, happened with in-home services and not with community-based residential.
It's just a quick question.
Sure.
We've asked, can you go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
Our last couple of meetings, we've tried to break this down more, where that increased cost came from, not just the way you've done it, but, you know, what the effect was of bargain wages, what the effect was of different categories inside there. We would have liked more specificity from the Lewin report than we got. It was pretty general.
Okay.
We have to do some specific things to fix this. So I know you're going to get the next slides and get to some of that, but there are some other factors. You know, how much did the expansion population affect it? How much was bargain cost?
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of things that we have to be aware of. And do we cut hours to people? Do we limit people? It's those kind of questions that really have to be answered. So, people, I just want to ask that we get more information later. Okay.
Okay, I probably will not be able to provide that at this point, but I will note that down.
Thank you, Chair Bates. You actually opened the line of questioning that I was interested in, particularly. This analysis is pretty sobering. I mean, it under the current parameters, the eligibility will be reduced, the services will be reduced, the payments will be reduced, and but I agree with the chair that this analysis is really not complete. It does not doesn't appear to address the approximately 30% increase in public employee compensation that will occur over the next 4 years. It's already been bargained for. It doesn't appear to address the rapid increase in the public employment retirement system employer contributions that are coming. That's going to reach, we're told, 30%, somewhere between 30% and 40% of payroll by 2020. And then it couldn't address the effects of the minimum wage bill that's currently working its way through the legislature.
Right.
And according to a February 3rd, 2016 report from DHS to LFO, those effects can be quite significant. It appears that in the APD division alone, it would be $5.8 million in 15-17 and $36.5 million in 17-19. And in the IDD division it would, in the 17-19, it would be $21.7 million, a total increase of $58 million, and that doesn't include the cost. The DHS did not include the cost of potential cost of the compression or of the roll-up on all this stuff. So I would certainly agree with the chair that the fiscal part of this really needs to be looked at a lot more closely to find out how big a cliff we're sailing over.
Your Co-Chair Bates and Senator Whitsett, you're absolutely correct. We did not account for minimum wage. We did account for some degree of the collective bargaining increases in the per participant payment increase assumptions over the time. It does not, though, account for Fair Labor Standards Act changes that are just being implemented now. So we had no basis on which to know what the impact of those might be.
Mm-hmm. Can we expect more results? I mean, is this study completed, or is it ongoing, or are you going to employ another study to try to put dollar figures on these things?
The time frame, I don't know. Let me please answer.
So, Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsett, the time frame for the initial study was, as I mentioned, a very short time frame. It was to come back and provide general options availability based on this. The department expects to continue to work with this committee, work with stakeholders and other individuals to look at recommendations around this. We obviously know that this is an important area that we need to be able to look at, and so we'll continue to work with there, and there may be opportunities that we continue to have discussions with Luden Group around what they found.
Representative Nathanson?
I want to follow up on that specific comment. Yes, of course the department will have to continue having discussions. We have to do something. My questions mostly have to do with, is this report what the department expected? Does it have sufficient detail to provide us with enough information to make informed decisions? Or was there something more that's still going to be provided and we just don't, in other words, the contract for a report hasn't been completed yet?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, ultimately, part of the reason the department went forward with an independent study was to see if there were options that we were not available, we did not know about. It was to bring in an outside impact, and really, I believe everyone was hoping that there'd be some sort of magic bullet, silver bullet, whatever term, phrase people want to do, to be able to find a way to resolve the issues we have, because we understand the services we provide to individuals are of the utmost importance, and how do we make sure that we can serve Oregonians in the most effective way for their safety and health and independence. In that, we asked the Lewin Group to look at the data and provide information back. The department is still continuing to go through the report that Lewin provided to us and is looking at the material, and I think can further come back and respond to that, but this time we're still looking at the information to see whether or not any of these information is enough for us to move forward with.
So may I follow up just
briefly?
Well, that's partially responsive. Okay. You're still trying to determine, is it enough data to provide some good suggestions or options? Did Lewin Group provide you with adequate data? Is this report what you expected as far as completeness of report when you contracted for information?
Representative Nathanson, Co-Chair Nathanson, I can do this today. Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. With the time frames of what we looked at around the report, I would agree that I would hope for more specifics around data. I, for one, parts of the work that I do, I'm always looking for very specifics around data. The per member per year information rolled up doesn't allow us to necessarily break down to some of the questions that you have specifically. You know, when we look at the growth in percentages and costs, you know, being able to attribute it to what portions of it. I do know that Lewin, in looking at the data sources and what the department was able to provide, had to break down and provide pieces of that. And so we did have some data issues that are addressed in the report that caused some delay in being able to get to the level of report that I would hope for. Okay. Ultimately, I do think that it does provide some basic options and reinforces that. Unfortunately, what I would love to come forward in front of this committee today and provide here as an answer is, from an independent perspective, not available at this time to us.
I'd like to follow that question up, if I could, myself for a moment. Did you have something else you wanted to ask?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
When we ask for consults from outside our state, we often like to get information of what other states are doing. So my question, and I don't know if you've done this for other states or looked to other states, we're looking at from 13 to now 16, incredible increases in payments to home care workers, as well as caseload increases.
Right.
Both sides are going up exponentially in crazy numbers we can't support. What's the experience in other states? Have they seen the same sudden increase in this population, or they handle it differently? And if they have, that's the kind of information that would have been helpful for us to look at.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, committee members. We did look at some other states within the report and are familiar with what other states have done. For example, California had a pretty large increase post-K implementation in its in-home services and supports program. And they actually ended up doing a 7% decrease in service hour allocations as a mechanism for reducing that. They subsequently figured out a way to do a provider tax and restored that, but will be in continued negotiation with the feds about whether that's sustainable or not. In New Mexico, when they went to an 1115 waiver and expanded access to home community-based services, they had a very large increase because they did not have all the infrastructure in place in order to handle that, and had to go back and really unwind and put all that infrastructure necessary. Oregon really does have the infrastructure. They have some of the most sophisticated monitoring of caseload, of cost and spending on a monthly basis that, you know, you all know what is going on a pretty real-time basis, and many other states do not have that capability and are not monitoring that closely, for example.
So there was nothing there that was helpful to us in resolving this issue that you saw in other states. Thank you.
Not particularly, aside from, you know, taking whacks at different things.
I think that's unfortunately what's going to happen in the end here. But thank you. Please continue.
Okay. So if we go to the next slide, we do try to, with the data that we had available, we're able to break it down into the components of increases in participants versus increases in payments per year for those participants. And as you can see, prior to implementation of the K-Plan and all of the other activities that happened between 13 and 14, there was a period where the biennium growth was less than 10%. But the 2 years prior to that, as well as since the K-Plan, it's been higher than 10% per biennium, which may call into question whether or not that's a reasonable goal, given the growth in the older population and some of the other issues around wages and other things. You can also see that for the APD population, the initial impact was around the cost per participant, and that has to do with the wage increase from 2013. It was flat from 2010 to 2013, and then there was a pretty large increase bargained. And then from 2014 to 2015, there's some sort of an equal split between participants and cost per participant.
So can you break that down for us at a later time?
With the data that we have, unfortunately not. We would need service level hours and or units, which we did not have.
Can the department do it?
Senator Bates, yes.
Can I follow
up? You're going to have to do this.
Yeah. Okay? Yes.
I mean, if you're going to get down to this problem, you have to do it. I've actually talked to my local people in our AAA, and they're looking at options, and they're going to present real options to us. And we're going to bring those forward.
I want to understand the little exchange we just heard. The data wasn't available to Lewin Group. Or I don't know whether that means you didn't ask for it or it wasn't provided to you, but the department says you can do it. That means you do have the data?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, part of the issues that we had around data and providing this to the Lewin Group, one is the amount of time. We have some data that we have protective status of, so we have to request from CMS to release it to third parties. Oh. So we can look in and do analysis of it. It's harder for us to share initially. And so that time frame came into account. We've also had changes in our systems and the technology. And as those changes have happened, data doesn't always line up easily. And so that's part of the work that we've done to be able to then pull together and look at the data sets. This is something, to the comments from the committee, this is something that we have been looking at and having constant discussions around. Bringing Lewin Group was to try to bring in a different perspective and see if there's other opportunities there. But we are constantly looking at our dollars or figures, working with budgets and other individuals to see if there are ways to look at cost strategies for sustainability, looking at the cost per case growth and the number of participants.
And one brief follow-up. We have to ask permission to share aggregated data?
It depends on the source. So to get to, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee, to get to the source of the data to do a per member per year structure would take into, so we have MDS data, this is some of our nursing facility data, you have other sources of data out there that's at some points to be able to get to that level. We would have to either have aggregated ourselves and provided it to Lewin Group in the way that they were breaking down the methodology independently of us. It may not have lined up. So that was some of the struggles that we have as we go through this. And part of our goal was also to see if they, in looking at the data, would find something that we may have missed.
Please continue.
Okay.
Nice to be the messenger, eh?
Always fun. So nursing facilities continue to have a declining caseload. And this, despite the fact, as I said, Oregon is leading the country in terms of the, if you do a per capita, actually per 65, age 65 plus Medicaid nursing facility users, you are the lowest in the country for that use rate. And yet you still have a declining Medicaid nursing facility caseload. It's a testament to your home community-based services side. For IDD, we were able to look at data from 2011 through 2015, and there was a 41% increase in that period, and 33.6% of that occurred post-K. And when we break that in children and adults, you can see adults are a much greater portion of that system's spending. Again, this is not including case management only. And when we look at the breakdown between participants and spending per participant, annual spending per participant, you'll see on the IDD side that it's much more of a case of increase in caseload. And as a percent, the increase was very high on children because you start out with a very low number of children in the system, and there's been a pretty significant growth in that. But actually looking at the total numbers, an equal number of increase in adults and in children pretty much over that period, so about 2,500 each. But because you started with such a smaller percentage for children, it's a much higher percentage on the children's side.
I asked Tom a question. I was really good. Where, sure. Where were those children being served before?
So how the children's waiver had a cap on enrollment.
So what would happen to kids who are outside the cap?
Their parents were probably taking care of them, but on their own.
There's natural supports.
There. Natural supports, yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll get that in the record. Thank you.
Okay. So again, the policy scenarios we looked at included kind of global, what would you need to reduce in terms of participants, and what would you need to reduce, assuming that the cost per participant stayed the same, and then what would you need to reduce in terms of payment per participant if the number of participants stayed the same, just to give you an order of magnitude of what you're facing. And then we looked at some specific scenarios around changing participant cost share, specifically repealing the $500 a month housing allowance, increased integration between primary acute pharmacy and LTSS, and leveraging technology to allow individuals to remain in their homes longer.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Are you going to go into more detail about those 5 points?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'll wait.
So on the APD side, our projection of the expenditures on the state side go from just over $600 million in the 2015 to 17 period to $1.1 billion by 2023-2025. That's about a 14.6 per annum on average over that period. It's a little bit, it's not quite a straight line. About half of that's caseload and half of it's payment per participant on the APD side. And so if we look at what would be necessary in terms of a reduction in the caseload by 2023 to 2025, you'd have to have about 6,000 fewer people receiving services, and that means a 15% increase over the period as opposed to about a 33% increase. So about half the rate of increase in participants would have to be achieved. We, in doing the estimate, you can see there's sort of a crook in the curve with the assumption that the full effect of the K plan on participants has not yet quite been felt until around 2020.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator.
Would it be fair to say that if all of the current and impending costs were included in the analysis, that delta would be a lot greater?
Yes.
Thank you.
On the IDD side, again, similar rate, similar starting point and similar ending point in terms of the total dollars, a little bit lower per biennium on average at 13.6%. And for this, a third of it, we estimated a third would be caseload and two-thirds would be payments per participant. And the result is a needed, to get to the 10% biennium, a needed reduction in caseload of about 2,700 in the 2023-2025. Again, these are people receiving services beyond case management only, and actually a lot of the increase in the people are people coming from case management only, on the adult side, from case management only over to services. And that's it. So instead of a 21% increase in participants, there would need to be only about 11% increase in participants over that period. If we look at changing the standard for eligibility for services for the APD side, the service priority levels, I know you're all very familiar with these, but they're listed here, 13, and we modeled two scenarios, one to include only 1 through 7, and the other to include only 1 through 4. Admittedly, these are pretty draconian kind of cuts, but it's one lever that you have in looking at ways to reduce the participant number of participants.
You didn't give us numbers associated with that directly on the slide of what those numbers would look like as far as
I have it in another slide or two. Basically, the fiscal impact could be high in a reduction. It's kind of a one-time reduction unless you phase it in over time or do something differently. You would expect to have higher per participant spending for those who remain, obviously because they have a higher acuity level. And it's going to have little effect on kind of the long-term trend expectations. So it's not, again, unless you're phasing it in over time, you're not really bending the curve. You're just sort of whacking it out 1 year. So here's where we have the estimates. And basically, dropping to a service priority level of 7 would result in an average annual biennium increase through 2023-2025 of about 7.5%, but that's because you'd have a 5% reduction, we assumed, in the between 2015-17 to 2017-2019. We assumed a July 2017 implementation for this. Dropping to an SPL4, again, you'd actually have a decline in overall spending on the home and community-based services side, and that's because you have a 28% reduction in that one-time reduction with reducing that many people. The consumer impact is obviously very high for this. 18% fewer participants if you go through the 1 through 7, 48% fewer participants if you go through 1 through 4, and not surprisingly, stakeholders are overwhelmingly opposed to this. Part of our charge was gathering some stakeholder input, and we had 3 different sessions in order to do that, and this is what we heard.
Senator Stern here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I deliberately waited until you got to this part to ask you a question related to slide 16, which is the one that explains what the service priority levels are.
Sure.
And we've had this conversation, so I'm not surprising, I think, the folks from APD, but I have significant concerns about these definitions, and one thing that I don't think is really addressed well in the report is the assessment tool that's being used and conversations about what this really means and how there may be some flex between some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, requires assistance with elimination. I mean, not to be too explicit, but that could mean sometimes they're not completely efficient at cleaning themselves after they limit. Well, what does that really mean, right? As opposed, does that really person really need help? Presumably, when they have elimination, they don't schedule it during the day, so they might need somebody there. You know what I'm saying? So it's a really, I find these definitions a little tough to wrestle with, and I recognize that the APD community has been using these for some time, but I just want to put on the record that I think we need to be thoughtful about how we're using these different service levels and how we're defining them to make sure that we really are serving the people who need us the most, and not making cuts that could externally appear somewhat inconsistent. And I, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, it's more of a statement, but I wanted to get it on the record since this committee, not everybody on this committee has been involved in all the conversations that some of us have been having with the APD folks. So I don't necessarily expect a response. You're welcome to if you want, but I just want to make sure that we have that conversation openly as well, because that issue isn't really in the official list of recommendations. it's not redefining how we talk about service levels. It's or what makes a service level something. We only talk about cutting back on the service levels we serve. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner-Hayward. That is a lever for looking at, you know, kind of where is the most need and where might you focus your resources. And, you know, different states use different methods. The beauty and the downfall of long-term services is every state pretty much has its own assessment tool. And so for those of us who try to look at things nationally across states, it's really tough. And so there's lots of examples out there of other ways of doing it. The really difficult thing, though, is that systems have ways of assessing and then assign amounts of services. And whether or not that marriage between the two is truly based on need and how you measure that, and you know the data, you know whether the data exists to actually disentangle, you know, are they getting this because that's what we allowed them to get, or are they getting this because that's what they actually need? And so that's where the difficult part is in terms of looking at kind of levels of service and then hours of service using existing data, because it's set up the way it is set up and that's the way it works, and it may not actually answer the question you're trying to ask, I think.
Thank you, quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. I understand your point entirely, and the last bit that I want to follow up on is something you said toward the end, which is, are they getting the service because they want it or because they truly need it? And one of the pieces of the conversation that I've had in multiple different contexts across various parts of my professional life is generational differences, mm-hmm. and the expectations from the greatest generation versus us baby boomers versus Gen Xers and into millennials about what they expect for institutional support, with that institutional support broadly construed. And I do think it's something we have to take into consideration as part of this, because we have seen a significant increase in the number of people under 65 who are getting services through APD now, which means that they are solidly baby boomers, which is a very different group of people than those who are over 70 at this point, who are, well, over 80, I guess, so who are almost all greatest generation. And so I just think we have to be aware of that. Again, I don't necessarily expect comment, although you may have seen some of this as you've looked at this issue across the states, that you're starting to see a generational shift in expectations.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Steiner, Hayward, it would be very difficult to know whether it's a generational shift. Obviously, there's a lot more people who are in the baby boomer, and that's why you have a lot more. So you have to kind of take the population increase out of it to some extent. And as we looked at the trends going forward, we tried to do that. So essentially, if you look at over the next 10 years, people 65 and older, the rate of growth is 4%. Because baby boomers are turning 65.
Yeah.
And, you know, their high use rate, their really high use rate will come 2030 when they're all 85 and older. And that's the scary part. But the part about a generational difference in terms of desire for services or, willingness to avail themselves to the system and ask, I haven't seen... no research that kind of documents that aspect.
Okay. I'll send the committee some stuff that I've been looking
Thank
at.
You. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So other approaches to consider in looking at caseload increases, obviously under the K plan, anybody who meets a level of care criteria is eligible to receive services. Under a 1915C authority, enrollment levels can be constrained. Oregon historically has not constrained those. You know, they've had limits or enrollment caps, but never reached them, with the exception of children with IDD. And given where you are now, that is one area of exploration. It does have the downside of no longer getting a 6% federal increase in the match. The other area is negotiating with CMS how to account for natural supports and service planning. The guidance that you received from CMS regarding natural supports and allocation of services seems open to further discussion with CMS. You know, they basically said you can't take that into account, and it seems, given where you are in your caseloads and the amounts of services that are being allocated, that might be an area to renegotiate or open negotiations again with CMS with more information about kind of what the impact has been. And finally, changing the ICFDD level of care criteria, increasing the number of areas required to meet an institutional level of care or modifying the IQ requirements among individuals with IDD could result in a one-time reduction in the number of individuals eligible for services, and again, likely a higher per participant payment due to the higher need levels. The state did not have easy access to data regarding the number of areas of impairment among current IDD because you have to get that from the counties. And again, our time frame did not allow for looking at that specifically, but that would be another area to explore. So if you move on to kind of the payments per participant and kind of what needs to happen in order to, if the caseloads remained at the levels projected, what would have to happen to the payments per participant. For APD, it would be about a $5,600 decrease, and it would mean ultimately a 9% on average increase in payments per participant rather than a 25% increase as projected. For IDD, it's about a $5,600 less payment in 2023-2025, and that means a 22% increase in payments per participant rather than a 34% increase over the period.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure.
Under the K waiver, can we cap payments? Can we say this is the upper limit of our payments?
In a sense, you already do with the service allocations. You allocate hours, and the hours cost X per hour. And so in a way, you do have a payment cap. So it would be around looking at the service allocations and the hours allocated in the, at least on the in-home side. Obviously on the community-based residential, that's a payment per day, and that's a different discussion.
I'm talking about in-home services, so people have a choice. You can take these services and stay in your home. At a certain point, it becomes too expensive to keep them there, and we're going to be financially moving better off moving out of their home. I know they don't want to do that. I'm not trying to be cruel. I just want to make sure we explore and have a conversation about all possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the question is, in in-home services, can we cap the number of hours?
You currently do, right?
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, what we can do is look at the formula. So this goes back to what Senator Steiner Hayward was discussing somewhat. Look at what we do for our assessment and the hours authorized. That'd be something that we'd work with around CMS to say, based on the needs, here's the number of hours. To have just a flat cap of saying the most services, we aren't allowed to do because it's based on the individual assessment and needs. But there are ways, ultimately, there are ways based on the assessment tool and what we look at for eligibility to be able to make some of those determinations.
And that's because CMS won't allow us to do that. Have you asked the question?
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, to my knowledge, we have not asked the question, but that's to my knowledge.
That's a fair answer. Thank you.
Uh-oh.
Come on.
Co-Chair Bates, Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance. I'm the APD Medicaid Long-Term Care Manager. And we actually did ask CMS when we wrote the K, and in the CFRs, they require that you have a functional needs assessment and the service plan for each individual meets the needs of the individual. So you can have caps, and we have caps and rules about the number of hours for in-home consumers, but then you have to have an exception process where the individual and the local case manager are proving that they have a need that is above that exceptional need or the standard need.
I'm not saying we're doing any of these things, but right. We have to change our thinking. This is not sustainable. If we say this is the number of hours we can give you to keep in your home, but if you have to go above that, then we have to move you to a community-based care. That's something we have to have a discussion about. I'm not saying we're going to do it. It's a discussion issue. At a certain point, to control costs, we got to be willing to move people a little bit and be careful about it. But everyone would rather stay at their home. I understand that. But if it costs you $100,000 to keep them in the home and you can move them someplace else for $50,000, you got to start talking about those things.
Co-Chair Bates.
It's painful conversations.
So we also had that conversation with CMS around, under the waivers, the individual service plan was capped, except for in extreme circumstances, at the cost that it would cost us to serve somebody in a nursing facility. And under the K, that you can't do that anymore. It's based on that functional needs assessment and meeting the needs of that individual. So you can no longer say, well, we can cap it at the nursing facility rate or cap it at this rate, et cetera, under the K because of the way the federal regulations are written.
I'm not talking about nursing home rates. Right. I'm talking about foster care rates. Okay. There's two very different things, as you know.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, it leads us to a further discussion of whether we want to stay in the K waiver or not, whether we can afford to. And that's a bigger discussion, but one we have to consider, too. The K waiver may have been a mistake. Something we just can't afford in this state. Now, I think other states are going to come up with the same problem. If they don't have a way of developing tools that really control these costs and still serve people in their homes and elsewhere. Hard stuff. Please continue.
Okay. The other lever is rate increases to provider payments. And I would imagine that would be a curve as to the rate increases as opposed to an actual reduction that you would be targeting. In looking at cost share, one of the things that was implemented as part of the K plan and actually part of the maintenance of effort requirement for Oregon was creating a new in-home allowance of $500 a month to cover living expenses while using the same income eligibility. So this did not expand the eligibility for people to receive these services, but it did allow them to retain up to $500 a month more, and that's only if they have income above SSI and only the amount up to $500. So if you only have $200 over SSI, you're only retaining $200 a month. So in looking at this, there might have be a little bit of a shift from community-based services to in-home, but most of the shift between community-based service to in-home was a reclassification of relative foster care. Actually, if you look at the data over time and look at community-based, there's like 1,200 people who move from community-based residential to in-home, and that did not have to do with this. It had to do with the shift in the adult foster home relative folks. You'd expect it could shift responsibility for up to $6,000 annually from the state to the participant. That's if they have the full $500 over the SSI limit. So again, the fiscal impact is that $500 a month and the possible reduction in the number of users who do not seek in-home services because they want to, they need that to cover their living expenses. So on the APD side, we estimated that repealing the in-home allowance would reduce spending about 5%. And again, it doesn't have much effect on the trend. It would be sort of a one-time effect. We already talked about this a little bit, but, you know, those who are in the program who have income above SSI would be paying, contributing more to their services. Consumers could choose not to enter the in-home program, and the state could save money due to reduced caseload, but we don't expect that to be a huge impact at all. Consumer choice to move to other home and community-based services or nursing facilities settings could be constrained with this reduction. And you end up spending more on those other settings than you do on in-home, potentially. Anything on that one? So increasing integration. We looked at three specific models for this. One is a state-administered managed care approach. One is capitalizing on the CCOs. CCOs, and the other is contracting for managed long-term services and supports. And greater integration has the potential to provide participants with, you know, better and holistic care, also to reduce unnecessary services, but probably more likely on the acute care side than on the long-term services and support side. And it could result in smaller increases in spending. And I fully appreciate, concerns. of imposing a medical model on supports that help people live their lives and that aspect of it. But however done thoughtfully and planfully, greater integration could improve long-term services and supports participants' experience of the healthcare system. And it also could provide an early warning system if the direct care workers are in a position to notice medical issues and report those to the health, you know, report those to appropriate people within the acute care system and pick that up earlier than might otherwise. Again, probably savings on the acute care side, not the long-term services support side, but it could mean a better experience of the healthcare system and a better health for the people who are participating in these programs. So again, on the three models, if the Department of Human Services and its community partners.
Excuse me. Sorry. Representative Nathanson has a question.
Thank you. So I'm looking at this section on integration models to pursue, and I understand the words, incorporate integration principles, common outcomes, accountability, coordinating care, transferring the payment rate risk. But could you give me just two or three examples of real situations where this is going to make a difference? You know, we could spend a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time and probably give the department, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of dollars to do some new, to design some new scheme for how we're going to do more integration or coordination. Give me a few examples of what real difference.
So, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson, the people who are served by these programs are some of your highest cost people. If I did a study where it looked at individuals with multiple chronic conditions, and people who have multiple chronic conditions but no functional impairments look a lot like everybody else in terms of their average spending. It's when the conditions result in a functional impairment that people seek services, seek healthcare services, because it's affecting and impacting their lives. So if you are able, so again, we have some of the highest cost people in these programs, both in terms of the long-term services and supports, but also on the acute care side. And they're the ones who have frequent readmissions and other sorts of readmissions is probably the best example. If you can intervene and avoid either an admission or readmission to a hospital, that's a significant amount of savings. CMS, on at least for Medicare, estimates it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000. if you are able to avoid that because early warning signs about water retention are noticed in the home and somebody appropriate is notified and things can happen as a result to keep people from going to the emergency room, ending up in the hospital, that can save the system money. It doesn't necessarily, again, save long-term services and supports money, but it is going to make the people's lives that much better because nobody wants to go to the hospital if they can avoid it.
Thank you for the example.
You're welcome.
I was not understanding how it was helping the problem that we have at hand, and indeed it may not, but it's addressing system-wide cost issues and the patient or the client specifically. I get it now.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Coach Nathanson, you've actually summarized my slide very well for me, so I don't know if I need to go further.
You've got 5 minutes to do a wrap if you can.
Okay. So the final area that we looked at was leveraging technology, and preceded by the rural folks, this is could be also used within this population in terms of monitoring. Again, in terms of for telehealth and also remote monitoring as potentials. So we discussed that a little bit in the report also. So recommended next steps. Our recommendation for next steps includes analyzing the distribution of participant income to better understand the implications of the cost share requirements and the in-home allowance. Comparing nursing facility residents to those receiving home and community-based services to identify if there are any further opportunities for community placement. Analyzing the IDD service allocation amounts relative to hours used in order to revisit the allocation methods, and the same could be done on the APD side. excuse me. And again, analyzing sort of that acute primary care as well as pharmacy claims to better understand the whole service use picture for these participants. And identifying specific interventions that could be improve care. It could be training for the direct care workers. It could be greater coordination and integration with interdisciplinary teams that include the case manager on the LTSS side. There are a number of options there. This was in the report. It just basically summarizes what we looked at. And in conclusion, I want to emphasize that Oregon has some of the most sophisticated and ongoing monitoring and forecasting for its programs relative to other states. There really are no easy answers here. The IDD issues differ significantly from the APD issues, and while you need to look at the system as a whole, you do need to look at those subgroups very carefully. As we noted, the projections do not include the Department of Labor's Fair Labor Standards Act implications, nor the proposed minimum wage bill, and sort of the bargained costs over time. We suggest using this as a jumping off point for further dialogue and analysis as you continue to understand the full implications of the K plan, and we think it's important to recognize kind of the growing population, the underlying demographics that are happening too, and in considering what kind of limits you want to put on these programs.
Thank you for your report. We're going to close now at 10, but I'd like to have a comment from LFO, and each can have a comment here before we take a motion.
I would just like to note that In looking at this material and getting ready for session, it did seem like this was going to be report was going to be coming in kind of late, not as early as we had hoped, and that there would be again some things that didn't get covered. I think maybe when the budget note was developed, it was envisioned there'd be this nice tidy little list of options and you can pick A, B, or C and solve the problem, and that's obviously not what you have before you today. I want to acknowledge that, knowing that, I still wanted the subcommittee to deal with this issue or have it before you in session, because if we waited to have a discussion in May, that's just that many more months down the road. So the issues need to be teed up. They need to be looked at. The work needs to be ongoing. I try to address sort of next steps or kind of planning in the analysis I wrote for you. And I would just like to recommend that you go ahead and acknowledge your seat, and we'll continue working on this.
Well, thank you, Lori. And I also wanted to thank people who went to evening meetings their time of lives to do that and sit and listen to the agency and try to get an understanding of an incredibly complex issue. Any other questions? Seeing none, I would take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to acknowledge receipt of the report.
We have a motion to acknowledge receipt of the report. Any discussion? Seeing none, anyone opposed to acknowledge or receive the report? Seeing none, we accept the report, and we'll need a carrier in full, and I think it's going to be me again.
I think that would be correct.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
Hot potatoes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned. Thank you.